Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
We're going to talk today about 18th century politics, and before everybody turns off and thinks, oh my God, what's that got to do with today? The reason it's interesting is as follows, that you can look at history in two different ways, and with history, the present and the future. You can either see it as a linear pattern in which essentially what happened in the past, particularly the distant past, has relatively little relevance because we are going into a different future. Or you can argue that there are recurrent situations, not necessarily patterns, but situations, and that what those do is, in apart from providing interest in the present, they also provide us with a way in which we can consider where we are now as part of a more long-standing nature of events, nature of challenges, to use the word of our day. I'm glad to say in the 18th century they didn't think of life in those terms. So what is the relevance of the 18th century here is that in the 18th century, you were working out a new political and governmental system. You were dealing with the new. And that's interesting because in a way, that's also our position today. We've actually only had a franchise which has had men and women equal and all of the adult population, thought of initially, obviously, as older than where we are at the moment, for less than 100 years. Women got the vote initially in 1918, but not on an equal basis for men. That occurred a decade later. And I think it's fair to say that much of our current politics is a working through of relatively recent developments. One can see this in particular with the extent to which the Scottish Parliament and the Welsh Assembly were created only by the Blair government, which came in and introduced referenda under which they were created. And we're talking about the referenda as recently as 1997. Or if you wish to argue that the political maelstrom of recent years and that which threatens to engulf the Conservative Party essentially derives from the response to the Brexit referendum and how that should be implemented, then you're talking about a very recent politics. And so also in the 18th century, in essence, there was a new constitution which was introduced as a result of the Glorious Revolution, the overthrow of James II of England, James VII of Scotland in 1688 to 1689, and the introduction of a parliamentary system in which Parliament met every year and in which there were regular elections, initially 3 years, then 7 years. We're currently at least every 5 years. We've got a quinquennial system. And the practicality of working out what parliamentary government meant and how it was to operate is one that took a long time. And you could argue, in a sense, rather than thinking in terms of a stable constitution, an obvious constitutional and political settlement, clear-cut practices, you can argue that the opposite was the case. And this clearly has consequences for how we think or should think of modern-day politics. You could argue that by its very nature, there is inherently a degree of not just inconstancy in politics, we know that, but of instability, different views about fundamental aspects of the constitutional, governmental, and political system. Whether in the 18th century you consider as that, for example, such issues as the relationship between the judiciary and the legislature, such issues as the relationship between Scotland and England, or England and Scotland on the one hand and Ireland on the other, all issues which in a way occur in the present day, albeit in different forms. And of course, in foreign policy, the closer relationship of Britain with the continent that followed the accession, invasion, as well as accession, by William III of Orange in 1688, has, and then subsequently in 1714, the Hanoverian dynasty, a dynasty of German rulers, there is obviously a interesting way of considering similarities and differences with the relationship between Britain and continental Europe over the last 50 years, longer now. And you can take that again further by saying that the question of the fundamental legitimacy of a Whig-run Church of England on behalf of those to Jacobites or High Tories were usurpers, as has interesting prefigurement of the situation that, as it were, arises in terms of what is the position of the Church of England in terms of modernity versus tradition in the modern age. Now, we could take this all a lot further. You could argue, for example, that modern social media, the anxieties and fears surrounding it, are not too different from the anxieties and fears surrounding the press after you, newspapers, in other words, and pamphlets as well, after you ended pre-publication censorship and after the foundation of the first daily newspaper, which was 1701. So that there are interesting ways to look at these issues, and you could take them further into broader questions of social behaviour. To some critics, there was a relative liberalisation of British society after the Glorious Revolution, and that led to women being less willing to accept traditional roles, etc., etc. Tended to be male commentators, of course, that said that. And that, again, you could argue, prefigured a long-standing recurrent pattern in the discussion of the position of women within society. Now, all of these points can be made. None of them underrate the specificity of a given period, and clearly there are specifics. It isn't the case that the past is like us. And when you get television programs or films suggesting that, as it were, the age of Jane Austen was no different from, as it were, that of the modern age, apart from my fact that I believe that there are zombies in a recent film about Pride and Prejudice, which I think is somewhat different to our modern concern about artificial intelligence. But with that exception, clearly in practical terms, though, there were enormous differences. The early 18th century, a very strong sense of providentialism, very strong sense that religion played a role in the fates of individuals and of nations, was not that which prefigures the situation today. In other words, I don't believe that the most ardent supporter of either Brexit or Remain would have argued that there was the equivalent of the Protestant winds that took William III to his invasion success in 1688, whilst holding up the ships that would have supported James II. You know, there are different accounts. People aren't so willing to wave the deity in order to explain what happens and should happen in particular political outcomes. But allowing for that, the clear similarity, and that similarity is one I think we should underline, is that there was no sense of inevitability, no sense of constancy, and no sense of a clear-cut constitution. At least, and this is an advantage for the 18th century, you didn't therefore have a ridiculous Supreme Court claiming that it could tell you what the Constitution said, which of course is a recent position in our country. What I think you do have is this very clear sense of a indefinite, almost undefinable quality to an age in flux. And you know, Graham's going to now come in and say a few things, but I think that point is the one I want to underline. We tend to think of the 18th century as fixed, stable, and as it were, only changing towards the end with the challenges of first the American Revolution and then those arising from French revolutionaries and their British supporters. I think that's mistaken. I think that the idea that you had a clear-cut political and constitutional system is one that is inaccurate. And I think that throws light on how we should look at subsequent British history, including modern British history.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Professor Black. I think it's a fascinating point you make about we shouldn't see the 18th century as some settled sense of itself. We do, or rather, historians often do describe it as the period of the Whig supremacy. And in doing so, convey a sense that there was some kind of guiding ideology that was dominant throughout the period. Is it a mistake to look at it in those terms? I mean, it's a simple fact that Whigs rather than Tories were in power for the vast majority of the 18th century. Is it nevertheless a mistake? Should we see fluidity between these terms? Many figures that we now describe as Tories, like William Pitt the Younger, were considered Whigs at the time. Are we attempting to create a party system with modern notions of party and political philosophy that didn't apply either consistently throughout the 18th century or maybe didn't even apply at all?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, several things to say there. The Tories tended to get the most votes in those seats which had a larger constituency. In other words, you're correct to say that the Whigs tended to win most seats in parliamentary elections. That's not the same thing as them having most votes, because the Whigs owned the vast majority of the pocket boroughs. And it's generally agreed by scholars, and you can think of work on the 1734 election in, for example, Paul Langford's book on the excise crisis. You can think of works like Nicholas Rogers' work or Kathleen Wilson's work on populous constituencies and cities like Norwich or Bristol. That it's generally agreed, Westminster, which was the largest of the urban boroughs, it's generally agreed that Tories or opposition Whigs, there were some opposition Whigs, got the most votes, but that didn't mean that they got won the elections. There was absolutely nothing like a boundary commission in the 18th century. Now, there are one or two Tory pocket boroughs, the Bruces, for example, who were a long-established Tory family, were that way, had seats. But the vast majority of borough managers were actually Whigs and ruthlessly used their situation to their credit. So what you've therefore got is a much more troublesome situation from our point of view, which is you've got Whigs arguing that although they have the minority of the vote or the minority of popular support, nevertheless, they argue they have, as it were, the true people as against the mob. Everybody in that period was convinced that those who voted the other way were the mob. And so the Whigs presented that as justifying their position. We've got to be cautious of taking the political rhetoric of that period and arguing that it describes reality. I mean, if you're thinking about some of the votes, I mean, the borough of Malmesbury had 13 voters. I mean, not sure we would necessarily see that in terms of whatever we mean by democracy. Or Gatton had 22, Whitchurch 85. And I've got a quote here from the Earl of Orrery. Now, he's an opposition figure, so that needs to be borne in mind. But he's complaining in 1721, which was a year of electoral campaigning. There are so many little venal boroughs that 'tis to be apprehended a majority will hardly be carried by the inclinations of the people only. And I think that was actually a very shrewd assessment. So, you know, it's rather like, if you want to think of it in electoral terms, think of it as being, say, the county seats are much more like the American Senate. America refers to itself as a democracy, but as you know, it's really a federation because, you know, Texas has the same amount of senatorial seats as Wyoming. And you would get exactly the same in 18th century Britain in the county seat. So Yorkshire, which was the most populous, has the same number of MPs as a seat with far fewer population, like, say, Dorset. And equally, Westminster, which is the borough with the largest population, has the same number of seats, two MPs, as Malmesbury, which has 13.
And there's also, of course, the uncontested elections, aren't there? I mean, right up to, I think, about the 1850s or so, a very large proportion of constituencies went with candidates being returned unopposed. Did they tend to be Whigs, or
a lot of them were Whigs, particularly because they tended to be obviously the borough seats. So there were, in the general election of 1741, there are only 94 contests and similar figures. 1722. You know, there's only 154 contests, 1727, 114. And what often happens is there'd be a deal so that you know, you get two seats for most constituencies. There are exceptions. City of London has four, Scottish seats tend to have one. But what would often happen is where you've got two seats is there'd be a deal. Note the last people that would ever be consulted if there's a deal are the electors, of course. In fact, one of the purposes of a deal is to cut the costs of managing a constituency, because what you do is, of course, the two major interests then, or those who are defined or can define themselves as the two major interests, agree that they'll put up one each, and therefore they will not have the need to actually ask people for the vote, which meant what were known as treating people. Well, treating people, if it was cheap, was buying a few drinks. I think it's fair to say that's not the usual pattern. So take Winchester. Now, you might think Winchester is a town and, you know, surely the town council should be, or the locals should be determining it. In fact, the Dukes of Bolton and the Dukes of Chandos, those are the two major local aristocratic families, dominate Winchester. And after the Winchester by-election of 1751, in the first 35 years, there are nine general elections and three by-elections. You have a by-election when somebody either dies or takes an office of profit under the crown. Not a single one of those is contested. Now, you could describe that as democracy if you like. I mean, there are other ways of looking at it. And, you know, you've got other families doing exactly the same. The Earls of Bristol and the Dukes of Grafton at Bury St. Edmunds. Or I mentioned the Bruces as Tories there at Marlborough, and the Dukes of Beaufort, who are also Tories, are at Monmouth. But most of the big families who have uncontested elections are Whigs, and that can include some quite major county seats. So Devon, where I live, and there are uncontested elections for the county representation between 1712 and 1790. And what you've got is you've got county families like the Courtenays, the Rolls, the Bamfields, you know, producing family members for the seats. And you take that a stage further, the Courtenays are the Earls of Devon. So in fact, the head of the family sits in the House of Lords, and another sprig of the rule of the family is in the Commons.
Mm-hmm. Well, fighting these elections where they are contested can be a very, very expensive business. It wasn't party funding in the way we'd understand it now. Would it be right to say that pretty much all party funding was decentralized, by which I mean the local families of influence from their own pockets did the funding? Or should we think of actually in a way there was state funding in so far as the government in power at the time could use various financial means to have leverage in individual constituencies?
Well, certainly the latter, absolutely. So but that tends to be the government. There isn't the opposition equivalent. So the government can use and did use both its own budget in terms of the Secret Service payments, which were regularly used for electioneering. You could instruct government placeholders, classically customs house officers in places like Harwich or Dover, both of which were parliamentary constituencies, would be expected to vote and organise people to vote for the government candidate. The opposition doesn't have the same facilities, but obviously the wealth of local families would play a role. And I mean, I've got a quote here from a John Evelyn, not the famous John Evelyn, another one, in 1702, and he's writing, quote, "The infamous borough of Mitchell, a paltry village," this is in Cornwall, "consisting of about 20 poor thatched cottages. The chief support of the place is election for burgesses, at which," those are the people that can vote in the elections, "at which time they make no scruple of selling their votes to the highest bidder and afterwards inform against their benefactors if the adverse party will bribe them to it," end of quote. The expense certainly encourages deals, as we've already mentioned, and because some of them are incredibly expensive. I mean, the Oxfordshire election of 1754 was notoriously expensive. It was a struggle between the Whig aristocracy and the Tory gentry, famously depicted by Hogarth. The result of that is that after 1754, there is no contest in Oxfordshire until 1826. That's quite a long time. There is no contest for the Nottinghamshire county seats between 1722 and 1832. There's none in Shropshire between 1722 and 1831. And, you know, I could go on. So one's got to, I think, be aware that you're absolutely right. Cost is an element. But because you cannot, so I mean, it's a poorer society, a much poorer society than today. And there also isn't the same sense that there is today about the need to fight seats that are seen as unwinnable. So, the idea of not contesting seats reflects not simply, a deal, but sometimes a shortage of money. But then again, you know, I'm sitting in Exeter and I think about the last general election here. In our last general election, we didn't have a Liberal Democrat candidate. Now, the Liberal Democrats had done a deal to support the Labour incumbent. And you could probably have some historian in 150 years' time pontificating that this represented an abuse of democracy, etc., etc. Or maybe even that there were financial reasons underlying. I'm not implying corruption, just, you know, wish to minimise their costs. For the Liberal Democrat decision. So one's got to be careful and accept that people at the time would have a reason.
Why did, and we should be careful treating, as we said, as you said earlier, treating the 18th century as if it was all the same. But what were the appeals of voting Whig or Tory in the first half of the 18th century? To what extent did the Whig attempts to paint Tories as Jacobites, when did that charge start to wear off and just become incredible?
Well, that's again very interesting. There's an enormous amount of controversy as to the role of Jacobitism in the Tory party. There were two very prominent scholars in the late 70s, early 80s. One of them, Evelyn Cruikshank, who argued for a strong Jacobite commitment on the part of the Tories. The other one, Linda Colley, who argued conversely, that was not the case. And then linked to that, but separate, was the argument that there was a genuine ideological tension in early 18th century politics, in which not just the succession, but the nature of religion played an enormous role, that the Whigs were mostly nonconformist or low church Anglicans, that the Tories were mostly high church Anglicans, and that this represented a fundamental ideological clash, that view being counterpointed by essentially secular readings of the party politics of the era. So I think it's fair to say that I'm going to try and offer you both points of view, but I think it's fair to say that you would find different emphases depending upon whom you ask. And one could take this a bit further. You should expect different emphases. It wasn't a monochrome country. You shouldn't expect the same configuration in politics in, say, Taunton, where there was a strong nonconformist element to politics, and that therefore had a consequence for the other political groupings there, as opposed to other areas where, quite frankly, there were very few nonconformists, and you would expect a different spur to political alignments and political energies. So, and you know, you've got geographical spreads, and one of the things we're not very good at in scholarship on the 18th century is looking at the regional dimensions of English politics, or indeed county studies, where there's been a lot of county studies of early 17th century English politics. And secondly, one needs the dynamic dimension. In other words, what might be the case for the 1715, 1722 or 1727 general elections might not be the case for the 1734, 1741 and 1747 general elections. So you need to be able to handle contrast. But going back to what I said at the beginning, I would suggest to you that just as we've probably underrated the role of religion in 18th century British as a whole, society and culture, so I suspect the same thing is true of 18th century, certainly early 18th century politics.
Well, the religious angle is very interesting, isn't it? The Tories for a long time in general elections repeated the line, you know, the church in danger. But I'm never clear why that line was successful in so far as it is, because it doesn't strike me that for most of the 18th century, the rights of the Church of England was in that much danger. How did that Tory appeal have such appeal as it did?
Well, I mean, I'm afraid to say not a lot of people would necessarily have agreed with you if you were a high Tory. I mean, think about Dr. Sacheverell and his famous sermon about the church being in danger among false brethren, and the way in which that and his trial by the Whigs or Whig-dominated House of Commons led to, you know, him becoming a celebrity, or more particularly helped the Tories enormously in the following general election. The argument was in effect, I'm not saying I would, you know, I'm just trying to give you some modern language. This is much more complicated. But the argument among Tories is that in effect, the country had been, particularly high Tories, the country had been taken over in 1688 to 89 violently, that it was a usurpation that had got rid of William III, that there had been, to use modern language, a kind of wokishness, or whatever you term that is now in favor, I have no idea, I don't really follow this. And that what therefore you get is you get in their eyes radical and sectarian notions which are being tolerated within an establishment, particularly a church establishment, which has lost its grip. And of course, they would argue that low church Anglicans are no different to dissenters. They would argue that that there are deists, free thinkers, etc., etc., and that the whole thing is a complete nightmare. So no, I wouldn't agree with you on that. Now, I'm not saying I agree with the analysis they offered. All I'm saying is that I would agree that many people felt anxiety. And of course, the novelists of the period, as you know, I've got a biography coming out on Henry Fielding and another one on Tobias Smollett. Both of those, you know, depict characters who very much hold these views. Now, Are we going to say the views are irrational? Well, there's several problems with this. First of all, that presupposes that you know where things are going, whereas by the very nature of things, political anxiety is based upon not knowing where things are going. Secondly, there definitely had been a change in the position, the legal and governmental position of the established church as a result of the Glorious Revolution, and there had been an extension of rights to dissenters, not to Unitarians, but to dissenters. And that led to anxiety about where this would lead to. And it's worth saying that the Whig Party, definitely up to the late 17-teens, when you have the Stanhope Sunderland ministry, very much tries to push through measures which are actively disliked by the vast bulk of the church hierarchy. And 1719 is in effect a political crisis as a result of that. Now, in Walpole's case, Walpole arises from this political crisis and the crisis following the South Sea Bubble and dominates politics from 1720, more clearly 21, until he falls from office in 1742. And what Walpole does is quite interesting. He runs a system which is a Whig monopoly of power at the centre, though there's lots of Tory justices of the peace, but in effect he ditches the pro religious change policies associated with Stanhope and Sunderland, and he tries to show that the church is safe under the Whigs. Now, there are one or two rows over tithes. He falls out in the end with the figure who is known as Walpole's Pope, Gibson, the Bishop of London. And as you're probably aware, if you roll through into the 1740s and 50s, there are other rows about the position of the Whigs. In particular, when they pass the Jewish Naturalisation Act, there's an anti-Semitic Church in Danger campaign, which is run in very strongly in 1753. There's a good book on that by T.W. Perry. But what I would say is, therefore, that although you or I might not feel that with the balance of time and the smoothness that history can offer to the past by smoothing it out and using terms like I use, the 18th century, as if the Church of England was in a safe position, that was certainly not how a lot of its more fervent supporters saw the position at the time. When you granulate history and say to yourself, not how does the next 50 years seem, but how does this year seem?
Well, that's a very strong point on which to end a very fascinating discussion about politics in the 18th century. I wish we had more time, but I'm afraid we don't. Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you. Readers might find interesting my 18th century Britain, but I think the more general point, and I hope we're going to continue this next week, is how we should look at the past, because by the nature of things, that relates to how we should look at the present. Because if you think about offering a smoothed version of the past and then think, well, are you going to offer a smoothed version of the present? And the answer would be no, we don't do that with political commentary today. And I think there is an interesting interaction there.
Yes, we will turn to that in our next episode. Professor Black, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.